still very lively, it seemed. She took her hand away and looked up at the circle of sky above the grove. "So beautiful here," she murmured, and her eyes drifted closed. Roland also felt himself drifting. It was ironic, he thought. This time she hadn't had that sensation of being watched, but the second time he had. Yet he would have sworn there was no one near this grove. No matter. The feeling, meagrim or reality, was gone now. He took Susan's hand and felt her fingers slip naturally through his, entwining. He closed his eyes. 9. All of this Rhea saw in the glass, and very interesting viewing it made, aye, very interesting indeed, but she'd seen shagging before, sometimes with 3 or 4, or even more doing it all at the same time, sometimes with partners who were not precisely alive, and the hokey-pokey wasn't very interesting to her at her advanced age. What she was interested in was what would come after the hokey-pokey. "Is our business done?" the girl had asked. "Mayhap there's one more little thing," Rhea had responded, and then she told the impudent trull what to do. Aye, she'd given the girl very clear instructions as the two of them stood in the hot doorway, the kissing moon shining down on them as Susan Delgado slept the strange sleep and Rhea stroked her braid and whispered instructions in her ear. Now would come the fulfillment of that interlude, and that was what she wanted to see, not two babbies shagging each other like they were the first two on earth to discover how 'twas done. Twice they did it, with hardly a pause to natter in between. She would have given a good deal to hear that natter, too. Rhea wasn't surprised. At his young age, she supposed the brat had enough spunkum in his sack to give her a week's worth of doubles, and from the way the little slut acted, that might be to her taste. Some of them discovered it and never wanted aught else. This was one, Rhea thought. "But let's see how sexy you feel in a few minutes, you snippy bitch," she thought, and leaned deeper into the pulsing pink light thrown from the glass. She could sometimes feel that light aching in the very bones of her face. But it was a good ache. Aye, very good indeed. They were at last done, for the time being, at least. They clasped hands and drifted off to sleep. "Now," Rhea murmured, "now, my little one, be a good girl and do as you were told." As if hearing her, Susan's eyes opened. But there was nothing in them. They woke and slept at the same time. Rhea saw her gently pull her hand free of the boy's. She sat up, bare breasts against bare thighs, and looked around. She got to her feet. That was when Musty, the six-legged cat, jumped into Rhea's lap, wowing for either food or affection. The old woman shrieked with surprise, and the wizard's glass at once went dark, puffed out like a candle flame in a gust of wind. Rhea shrieked again, this time with rage, and seized the cat before it could flee. She hurled it across the room into the fireplace. That was as dead a hole as only a summer fireplace can be, but when Rhea cast a bony, misshapen hand at it, a yellow gust of flame rose from the single half-charred log lying in there. Musty screamed and fled from the hearth with his eyes wide and his split tail smoking like an indifferently butted cigar.
"Run, aye!" Rhea spat after him. "Begone, you vile cusk!"
She turned back to the glass and spread her hands over it, thumb to thumb. But although she concentrated with all her might, willed until her heart was beating with a sick fury in her chest, she could do no more than bring back the ball's natural pink glow. No images appeared. This was bitterly disappointing, but there was nothing to be done. and in time she would be able to see the results with her own two natural eyes, if she cared to go to town and do so. Everybody would be able to see. Her good humor restored, Rhea returned the ball to its hiding place. 10. Only moments before he would have sunk too deep in sleep to have heard it, a warning bell went off in Roland's mind. Perhaps it was the faint realization that her hand was no longer entwined with his. Perhaps it was raw intuition. He could have ignored that faint bell, and almost did. But in the end, his training was too strong. He came up from the threshold of real sleep, fighting his way back to clarity as a diver kicks for the surface of a quarry. It was hard at first, but became easier. As he neared wakefulness, his alarm grew. He opened his eyes and looked to his left. Susan was no longer there. He sat up, looked to his right, and saw nothing above the cut of the stream. Yet he felt that she was in that direction all the same. Susan? No response. He got up, looked at his pants, and Court, a visitor he never would have expected in such a romantic bower as this, spoke up gruffly in his mind. No time, maggot. He walked naked to the bank and looked down. Susan was there, all right, also naked, her back to him. She had unbraided her hair. It hung, loose gold, almost all the way to the lyre of her hips. The chill air rising from the surface of the stream shivered the tips of it like mist. She was down on one knee at the edge of the running water. One arm was plunged into it almost to the elbow. She searched for something, it seemed. Susan. No answer. And now a cold thought came to him. She's been infested by a demon. While I slept heedless beside her, she's been infested by a demon. Yet he did not think he really believed that. If there had been a demon near this clearing, he would have felt it. Likely both of them would have felt it, the horses too. But something was wrong with her. She brought an object up from the stream bed and held it before her eyes in her dripping hand. A stone. She examined it, then tossed it back. Plunk. She reached in again, head bent, two sheaves of her hair now actually floating on the water, the stream prankishly tugging them in the direction it flowed. Susan! No response. She plucked another stone out of the stream. This one was a triangular white quartz, shattered into a shape that was almost like the head of a spear. Susan tilted her head to the left and took a sheaf of her hair in her hand, like a woman who means to comb out a nest of tangles. But there was no comb, only the rock with its sharp edge, and for a moment longer Roland remained on the bank, frozen with horror, sure that she meant to cut her own throat out of shame and guilt over what they'd done. In the weeks to come he was haunted by a clear knowledge. If it had been her throat she'd intended, he wouldn't have been in time to stop her. Then the paralysis broke, and he hurled himself down the bank, unmindful of the sharp stones that gouged the soles of his feet. Before he reached her, she had already used the edge of the quartz to cut off part of the golden tress she held. Roland seized her wrist and pulled it back. He could see her face clearly now. What could have been mistaken for serenity from the top of the bank now looked like what it really was. Vacuity. Emptiness. When he took hold of her, the smoothness of her face was replaced by a dim and fretful smile. Her mouth quivered as if she felt distant pain, and an almost formless sound of negation came from her mouth. Some of the hair she had cut off lay on her thigh like gold wire. Most had fallen into the stream and been carried away. Susan pulled against Roland's hand, trying to get the sharp edge back to her hair, wanting to continue her mad barbering. The two of them strove together like arm wrestlers in a barroom contest, and Susan was winning. He was physically the stronger, but not stronger than the enchantment which held her. Little by little, the white triangle of quartz moved back toward her hanging hair. That frightening sound kept drifting from her mouth. "Susan, stop it! Wake up!" Her bare arm quivering visibly in the air, the muscles bunched like hard little rocks, and the quartz moving closer and closer to her hair, her cheek, the socket of her eye. Without thinking about it, it was the way he always acted most successfully, Roland moved his face close to the side of hers, giving up another 4 inches to the fist holding the stone in order to do it. He put his lips against the cup of her ear and then clucked his tongue against the roof of his mouth. Clucked side mouth, in fact. Susan jerked back from that sound, which must have gone through her head like a spear. Her eyelids fluttered rapidly, and the pressure she was exerting against Roland's grip eased a little. He took the chance and twisted her wrist.
Ow! Ow!
The stone flew out of her opening hand and splashed into the water. Susan gazed at him, now fully awake, her eyes filled with tears and bewilderment. She was rubbing her wrist, which Roland thought was likely to swell.
"You hurt me, Roland. Why did you hurt me?"
She trailed off, looking around. Now not just her face, but the whole set of her body expressed bewilderment. She moved to cover herself with her hands, then realized they were still alone, and dropped them to her sides. She glanced over her shoulder at the footprints, all of them bare, leading down the bank.
"How did I get down here?" she asked. "Did they carry me after I fell asleep? And why did thee hurt me? Oh, Roland, I love thee. Why did you hurt me?"
He picked up the strands of hair that still lay on her thigh and held them in front of her. "You had a stone with a sharp edge. You were trying to cut yourself with it, and you didn't want to stop. I hurt you because I was scared. I'm just glad I didn't break your wrist. At least I don't think I did." Roland took it and rotated it gently in either direction, listening for the grate of small bones. He heard nothing, and the wrist turned freely. As Susan watched, stunned and confused, he raised it to his lips and kissed the inner part, above the delicate tracery of veins. 11. Roland had tied Rusher just far enough into the willows so the big gelding could not be seen by anyone who happened to come riding along the drop. "Be easy," Roland said, approaching. "Be easy, a little longer, good heart." Rusher stamped and whickered as if to say he could be easy until the end of the age, if that was what were required. Roland flipped open his saddlebag and took out the steel utensil that served as either a pot or a fry pan, depending on his needs. He started away, then turned back. His bedroll was tied behind Rusher's saddle. He had planned to spend the night camped out on the drop, thinking. There had been a lot to think about, and now there was even more. He pulled one of the rawhide ties, reached inside the blankets, and pulled out a small metal box. This he opened with a tiny key he drew from around his neck. Inside the box was a small square locket on a fine silver chain. Inside the locket was a line drawing of his mother, and a handful of extra shells, not quite a dozen. He took one, closed it in his fist, and went back to Susan. She looked at him with wide, frightened eyes.
"I don't remember anything after we made love the second time," she said, "only looking up at the sky and thinking how good I felt, and going to sleep. Oh, Roland, how bad does it look?"
"Not bad, I should think. But you'll know better than I, here." He dipped his cooker full of water and set it on the bank. Susan bent over it apprehensively, laying the hair on the left side of her head across her forearm, then moving the arm slowly outward, extending the tress in a band of bright gold. She saw the ragged cut at once. She examined it carefully, then let it drop, with a sigh more relieved than rueful.
"I can hide it," she said. "When it's braided, no one will know. And after all, 'tis only hair, no more than woman's vanity. My aunt has told me so often enough, certainly. But, Roland, why? Why did I do it?"
Roland had an idea. If hair was a woman's vanity, then hair chopping would likely be a woman's bit of nastiness. A man would hardly think of it at all. The mayor's wife? Had it been her? He thought not. It seemed more likely that Rhea, up there on her height of land, looking north toward the Bad Grass, Hanging Rock, and Eyebolt Canyon, had set this ugly trap. Mayor Thorin had been meant to wake up on the morning after the Reap with a hangover and a bald-headed Jilly. "Susan, can I try something?" She gave him a smile. "Something you didn't try already up yonder?" "Aye, what you will." "Nothing like that." He opened the hand he had held closed, showing the shell. "I want to try and find out who did this to you and why. And other things, too. He just didn't know what they were yet." She looked at the shell. Roland began to move it along the back of his hand, dancing it back and forth in a dexterous weaving. His knuckles rose and fell like the heddles of a loom. She watched this with a child's fascinated delight.
"Where did you learn that?"
"At home. It doesn't matter."
"He had hypnotized me?"
"Aye. And I don't think it would be for the first time." He made the shell dance a bit faster, now east along his rippling knuckles, now west. "May I?"
"Aye," she said. "If you can."
12. He could, all right. The speed with which she went under confirmed that this had happened to Susan before, and recently. Yet he couldn't get what he wanted from her. She was perfectly cooperative, some sleep-eager, Court would have said. But beyond a certain point she would not go. It wasn't decorum or modesty, either. As she slept open-eyed before the stream, she told him in a far-off but calm voice about the old woman's examination and the way Rhea had tried to fiddle her up. At this, Roland's fists clenched so tightly his nails bit into his palms. But there came a point when she could no longer remember. She and Rhea had gone to the door of the hut, Susan said, and there they had stood, with the kissing moon shining down on their faces. The old woman had been touching her hair, Susan remembered that much. The touch revolted her, especially after the witch's previous touches, but Susan had been unable to do anything about it. Arms too heavy to raise, tongue too heavy to speak. She could only stand there while the witch whispered in her ear. "What?" Roland asked. "What did she whisper?"
"I don't know," Susan said. "The rest is pink."
"Pink? What do you mean?"
"Pink,"
she repeated. She sounded almost amused, as if she believed Roland was being deliberately dense.
"She says, 'Aye, lovely, just so, it's a good girl you are.' Then everything's pink, pink and bright."
"Bright?"
"Aye, like the moon. And then—"
She paused.
"Then I think it becomes the moon. The kissing moon, mayhap. A bright pink kissing moon, as round and full as a grapefruit."
He tried other ways into her memory with no success. Every path he tried ended in that bright pinkness, first obscuring her recollection and then coalescing into a full moon. It meant nothing to Roland. He'd heard of blue moons, but never pink ones. The only thing of which he was sure was that the old woman had given Susan a powerful command to forget. He considered taking her deeper. She would go, but didn't dare. Most of his experience came from hypnotizing his friends, classroom exercises that were larky and occasionally spooky. Always there had been Court or Vanet present to make things right if they went off track. Now there were no teachers to step in. For better or worse, the students had been left in charge of the school. What if he took her deep and couldn't get her back up again? And he had been told there were demons in the below mind as well. If you went down to where they were, they sometimes swam out of their caves to meet you. All other considerations aside, it was getting late. It wouldn't be prudent to stay here much longer. "Susan, do you hear me?"
"Aye, Roland, I hear you very well."
"Good. I'm going to say a rhyme. You'll wake up as I say it. When I'm done, you'll be wide awake and remember everything we've said. Do you understand?"
"Aye."
"Listen. Bird and bear and hare and fish, give my love her fondest wish."
Her smile as she rose to consciousness was one of the most beautiful things he had ever seen. She stretched, then put her arms around his neck and covered his face with kisses.
You, she said. You're my fondest wish, Roland. You're my only wish. You and you forever and ever.
They made love again there on the bank, beside the babbling stream, holding each other as tightly as they could, breathing into each other's mouths, and living on each other's breath. You. XIII 20 minutes later, he boosted her onto Felicia's back. Susan leaned down, took his face in her hands, and kissed him soundly.
"When will I see you again?"
she asked. "Soon, but we must be careful."
"Aye, careful as two lovers ever were, I think. Thank God thee's clever."
"We can use Sheeny if we don't use him too often."
"Aye. And, Roland, do you know the pavilion in Greenheart, close to where they serve tea and cakes and things when the weather's fair?"
Roland did. 50 yards or so up Hill Street from the jail and the town gathering hall, Greenheart was one of the most pleasant places in town, with its quaint paths, umbrella-shaded tables, grassy dancing pavilion, and menagerie.
"There's a rock wall at the back," she said, "between the pavilion and the menagerie. If you need me badly..."
"I'll always need you badly," he said. She smiled at his gravity.
"There's a stone on one of the lower courses, a reddish one. You'll see it. My friend Amy and I used to leave messages there for each other when we were little girls. I'll look there when I can. Ye do the same."
"Aye." Sheeny would work for a while if they were careful. The red rock might also work for a while if they were careful, but no matter how careful they were, they would slip eventually, because the big coffin hunters now probably knew more about Roland and his friends than Roland ever would have wished. But he had to see her, no matter what the risks. If he didn't, he felt he might die. And he only had to look at her to know she felt the same. "Watch special for Jonas and the other two," he said.
"I will. Another kiss, if you favor."
He kissed her gladly, and would just as gladly have pulled her off the mare's back for a fourth go-round. But it was time to stop being delirious and start being careful. "Fare you well, Susan. I love you..." He paused, then smiled. "I love thee."
"And I thee, Roland. What heart I have is yours."
She had a great heart, he thought as she slipped through the willows, and already he felt its burden on his own. He waited until he felt sure she must be well away. Then he went to rush her and rode off in the opposite direction, knowing that a new and dangerous phase of the game had begun. 14. Not too long after Susan and Roland had parted, Cordelia Delgado stepped out of the Hambry Mercantile with a box of groceries and a troubled mind. The troubled mind was caused by Susan, of course, always Susan, and Cordelia's fear that the girl would do something stupid before reaping finally came around. These thoughts were snatched out of her mind, just as hands, strong ones, snatched the box of groceries from her arms. Cordelia cawed in surprise, shaded her eyes against the sun, and saw Eldred Jonas standing there between the bear and turtle totems, smiling at her. His hair, long and white and beautiful, in her opinion, lay over his shoulders. Cordelia felt her heart beat a little faster. She had always been partial to men like Jonas, who could smile and banter their way to the edge of risqueness, but who carried their bodies like blades.
"I startled you. I cry your pardon, Cordelia."
"Nay," she said, sounding a little breathless to her own ears. "It's just the sun, so bright at this time of day."
"I'd help you a bit on your way, if you give me leave. I'm only going up high as far as the corner, then I turn up the hill, but may I help you that far?"
"With thanks," she said.
They walked down the steps and up the board sidewalk, Cordelia looking around in little pecking glances to see who was observing them, she beside the handsome Cy Jonas, who just happened to be carrying her goods. There was a satisfying number of onlookers. She saw Millicent Ortega, for one, looking out of Anne's dresses with a satisfying O of surprise on her stupid cow's puss.
"I hope you don't mind me calling you Cordelia."
Jonas shifted the box, which she'd needed two hands to carry, casually under one arm.
"I feel, since the welcoming dinner at Mayor Thorin's house, that I know you."
"Cordelia's fine."
"And may I be Eldred to you?"
"I think Mr. Jonas will do a bit longer," she said, then favored him with what she hoped was a coquettish smile.
Her heart beat faster yet. It did not occur to her that perhaps Susan was not the only silly goose in the Delgado family.
"So be it,"
Jonas said, with a look of disappointment so comic that she laughed.
"And your niece, is she well?"
"Quite well, thank you for asking. A bit of a trial, sometimes."
"Was there ever a girl of 16 who wasn't?"
"I suppose not."
"Yet you have additional burdens regarding her this fall. I doubt if she realizes that, though."
Cordelia said nothing, 'twouldn't be discreet, but gave him a meaningful look that said much.
"Give her my best, please."
"I will."
But she wouldn't. Susan had conceived a great and irrational, in Cordelia's view, dislike for Mayor Thorin's regulators. Trying to talk her out of these feelings would likely do no good. Young girls thought they knew everything. She glanced at the star peeking unobtrusively out from beneath the flap of Jonas's vest.
"I understand you've taken on an additional responsibility in our undeserving town," sighed Jonas.
"I am helping out Sheriff Avery," he agreed.
His voice had a reedy little tremble, which Cordelia found quite endearing somehow.
"One of his deputies, Claypool, his name is,
Frank Claypool, aye,
fell out of his boat and broke his leg." "How do you fall out of a boat and break your leg, Cordelia?"
She laughed merrily. The idea that everyone in Hambury was watching them was surely wrong, but it felt that way, and the feeling was not unpleasant, and said she didn't know. He stopped on the corner of High and Camino Vega, looking regretful.
"Here's where I turn."
He handed the box back to her.
"Are you sure you can carry that? I suppose I could go on with you to your house."
"No need. No need. Thank you. Thank you, Eldred."
The blush which crept up her neck and cheeks felt as hot as fire, but his smile was worth every degree of heat. He tipped her a little salute with two fingers and sauntered up the hill toward the sheriff's office. Cordelia walked on home. The box, which had seemed such a burden when she stepped out of the mercantile, now seemed to weigh next to nothing. This feeling lasted for half a mile or so, but by the time her house came into view, she was once again aware of the sweat trickling down her sides and the ache in her arms. Thank the gods summer was almost over. And wasn't that Susan just leading her mare in through the gate? "Susan," she called, now enough returned to earth for her former irritation with the girl to sound clear in her voice.
"Come and help me before I drop this and break the eggs."
Susan came, leaving Felicia to crop grass in the front yard. 10 minutes earlier, Cordelia would have noticed nothing of how the girl looked. Her thoughts had been too wrapped up in Eldred Jonas to admit of much else. But the hot sun had taken some of the romance out of her head and returned her feet to earth. And as Susan took the box from her, handling it almost as easily as Jonas had done, Cordelia thought she didn't much care for the girl's appearance. Her temper had changed, for one thing, from the half-hysterical confusion in which she'd left to a pleasant and happy-eyed calmness. That was the Susan of previous years, to the sleeve and seam, but not this year's moaning, moody breast-beater. There was nothing else Cordelia could put her finger on, except—but there was, actually, one thing,
She reached out and grasped the girl's braid, which looked uncharacteristically sloppy this afternoon. Of course, Susan had been riding. That could explain the mass. But it didn't explain how dark her hair was, as if that bright mass of gold had begun to tarnish. And she jumped almost guiltily when she felt Cordelia's touch. Why, pray tell, was that? "Your hair's damp, Susan," she said. "Have ye been swimming somewhere?" "Nay, I stopped and ducked my head at the pump outside Hookie's barn." "He doesn't mind. 'Tis a deep well he has. It's so hot. Perhaps there'll be a shower later. I hope so. I gave Felicia to drink as well."
The girl's eyes were as direct and as candid as ever, but Cordelia thought there was something off in them just the same. She couldn't say what. The idea that Susan might be hiding something large and serious did not immediately cross Cordelia's mind. She would have said her niece was incapable of keeping a secret any greater than a birthday present or a surprise party, and not even such secrets as those for more than a day or two. And yet something was off here. Cordelia dropped her fingers to the collar of the girl's riding shirt. "Yet this is dry." "I was careful," she said, looking at her aunt with a puzzled eye. "Dirt sticks worse to a wet shirt. You taught me that, aunt."
"Ye flinched when I touched your hair, Susan."
"Aye," Susan said, "so I did. The weird woman touched it just that same way. I haven't liked it since. Now may I take these groceries in and get my horse out of the hot sun?"
"Don't be pert, Susan."
Yet the edginess in her niece's voice actually eased her in some strange way. That feeling that Susan had changed somehow, that feeling of offness, began to subside.
"Then don't be tiresome."
"Susan, apologize to me."
Susan took a deep breath, held it, then let it out.
"Yes, Aunt, I do, but it's hot."
"Aye? Put those in the pantry. And thank ye."
Susan went on toward the house with the box in her arms. When the girl had enough of a lead so they wouldn't have to walk together, Cordelia followed. It was all foolishness on her part, no doubt, suspicions brought on by her flirtation with Eldred. But the girl was at a dangerous age, and much depended on her good behavior over the next 7 weeks. After that, she would be Thorin's problem, but until then, she was Cordelia's. Cordelia thought that in the end, Susan would be true to her promise, but until reaping fair, she would bear close watching. About such matters as a girl's virginity, it was best to be vigilant. Interlude. Kansas. Somewhere. Somewhen. Eddie stirred. Around them the thinny still whined like an unpleasant mother-in-law. Above them the stars gleamed as bright as new hopes, or bad intentions. He looked at Susanna, sitting with the stumps of her legs curled beneath her. He looked at Jake, who was eating a burrito. He looked at Oi, whose snout rested on Jake's ankle, and who was looking up at the boy with an expression of calm adoration. The fire was low, but still it burned. The same was true of Demon Moon far in the west. "Roland," his voice sounded old and rusty to his own ears. The gunslinger, who had paused for a sip of water, looked at him with his eyebrows raised.
"How can you know every corner of this story?"
Roland seemed amused. "I don't think that's what you really want to know, Eddie." He was right about that. Old Long, Tall and Ugly made a habit of being right. It was, as far as Eddie was concerned, one of his most irritating characteristics.
"All right, how long have you been talking? That's what I really want to know."
"Are you uncomfortable? Want to go to bed?"
"He's making fun of me," Eddie thought. But even as the idea occurred to him, he knew it wasn't true. And no, he wasn't uncomfortable.
There was no stiffness in his joints, although he had been sitting cross-legged ever since Roland had begun by telling them about Rhea and the glass ball, and he didn't need to go to the toilet. Nor was he hungry. Jake was munching the single leftover burrito, but probably for the same reason folks climb Mount Everest, because it was there. And why should he be hungry, or sleepy, or stiff? Why, when the fire still burned,
and the moon was not yet down. He looked at Roland's amused eyes and saw the gunslinger was reading his thoughts.
"No, I don't want to go to bed. You know I don't. But, Roland, you've been talking a long time."
He paused, looked down at his hands, then looked up again, smiling uneasily.
"Days," I would have said.
"But time is different here. I've told you that. Now you see for yourself. Not all nights are the same length just recently. Days either. But we notice time more at night, don't we?"
"Yes, I think we do."
"Is the thinny stretching time?" And now that he had mentioned it, Eddie could hear it in all its creepy glory, a sound like vibrating metal, or maybe the world's biggest mosquito. "It might be helping, but mostly it's just how things are in my world." Susanna stirred like a woman who rises part way from a dream that holds her like sweet quicksand. She gave Eddie a look that was both distant and impatient.
"Let the man talk, Eddie."
"Yeah," Jake said, "let the man talk." And Oi, without raising his snout from Jake's ankle,
"Enoch."
"All right," Eddie said, "no problem." Roland swept them with his eyes.
"Are you sure? The rest is..."
He didn't seem able to finish, and Eddie realized that Roland was scared.
"Go on," Eddie told him quietly. "Let the rest be what it is, what it was."
He looked around. Kansas. They were in Kansas. Somewhere, some when. Except he felt that Magus and those people he had never seen, Cordelia and Jonas and Brian Hookie and Sheamy and Petty the Trotter and Cuthbert Allgood, were very close now. That Roland's lost Susan was very close now. Because reality was thin here, as thin as the seat in an old pair of blue jeans, and the dark would hold for as long as Roland needed it to hold. Eddie doubted if Roland even noticed the dark, particularly. Why would he? Eddie thought it had been night inside of Roland's mind for a long, long time. And dawn was still nowhere near. He reached out and touched one of those calloused killer's hands. Gently he touched it, and with love.
"Go on, Roland. Tell your tale. All the way to the end."
"All the way to the end," Susanna said dreamily. "Cut the vein."
Her eyes were full of moonlight.
"All the way to the end," Jake said.
"End," Oi whispered.
Roland held Eddie's hand for a moment, then let it go. He looked into the guttering fire without immediately speaking, and Eddie sensed him trying to find the way. Trying doors, one after another, until he found one that opened. What he saw behind it made him smile and look up at Eddie.
"True love is boring," he said.
"Say what?"
"True love is boring," Roland repeated. "As boring as any other strong and addicting drug. And, as with any other strong drug..."
Part 3. Come Reap. Chapter 1. Beneath the Huntress Moon. 1. True love, like any other strong and addicting drug, is boring. Once the tale of encounter and discovery is told, kisses quickly grow stale and caresses tiresome. Except, of course, to those who share the kisses, who give and take the caresses, while every sound and color of the world seems to deepen and brighten around them. As with any other strong drug, true first love is really only interesting to those who have become its prisoners. And, as is true of any other strong and addicting drug, true first love is dangerous. 2. Some called Huntress the last moon of summer, some called it the first of fall. Whichever it was, it signaled a change in the life of the barony.
Men put out into the bay wearing sweaters beneath their oilskins as the winds began to turn more and more firmly into autumn's east-west alley and to sharpen as they turned. In the great barony orchards north of Hambry and in smaller orchards owned by John Croydon, Henry Wertner, Jake White, and the morose but wealthy Coral Thorin, the pickers began to appear in the rows, carrying their odd off-kilter ladders. They were followed by horse-drawn carts full of empty barrels. Downwind of the cider houses, especially downwind of the great barony cider mansion a mile north of Seafront, the breezy air was filled with the sweet tang of blems being pressed by the basket load. Away from the shore of the clean sea, the days remained warm as the huntress waxed, skies were clear day and night, but summer's real heat had departed with the peddler. The last cutting of hay began and was finished in the run of a week. That last one was always scant, and ranchers and freeholders alike would curse it, scratching their heads and asking themselves why they even bothered. But come rainy, blousy old March, with the barn lofts and bins rapidly emptying, they always knew. In the barony's gardens, the great ones of the ranchers, the smaller ones of the freeholders, and the tiny backyard plots of the townsfolk, men and women and children appeared in their old clothes and boots, their sombreros and sombreras. They came with the legs of their pants tied down firmly at the ankles, for in the time of the huntress, snakes and scorpions in plentiful numbers wandered east from the desert. By the time old Demon Moon began to fatten, a line of rattlers would hang from the hitching posts of both the Traveler's Rest and the Mercantile across the street. Other businesses would similarly decorate their hitching posts, but when the prize for the most skins was given on reaping day, it was always the inn or the market that won it. In the fields and gardens, baskets to pick into were cast along the rows by women with their hair tied up in kerchiefs and reap charms hidden in their bosoms. The last of the tomatoes were picked, the last of the cucumbers, the last of the corn, the last of the peri and mingo. Waiting behind them, as the days sharpened and the autumn storms began to near, would come squash, sharproot, pumpkins, and potatoes. In Magus the time of reaping had begun, while overhead, clearer and clearer on each starry night, the huntress pulled her bow and looked east, over those strange, watery leagues no man or woman of mid-world had ever seen. 3. Those in the grip of a strong drug, heroin, devil grass, true love, often find themselves trying to maintain a precarious balance between secrecy and ecstasy as they walk the tightrope of their lives. Keeping one's balance on a tightrope is difficult under the soberest circumstances. Doing so while in a state of delirium is all but impossible. Completely impossible in the long run. Roland and Susan were delirious, but at least had the thin advantage of knowing it. And the secret would not have to be kept forever, but only until reaping day fair at the very longest. Things might end even sooner than that if the big coffin hunters broke cover. The actual first move might be made by one of the other players, Roland thought, but no matter who moved first, Jonas and his men would be there, a part of it, the part apt to be most dangerous to the three boys. Roland and Susan were careful as delirious people could be, at any rate. They never met in the same place twice in a row, they never met at the same time twice in a row, they never skulked on their way to their trysts. In Hambry, riders were common, but skulkers were noticed. Susan never tried to cover her riding out by enlisting the help of a friend, although she had friends who would have done her this service. People who needed alibis were people keeping secrets. She had a sense that Aunt Cord was growing increasingly uneasy about her rides, particularly the one she took in the early evenings, but so far she accepted Susan's oft-repeated reason for them. She needed time to be solitary, to meditate on her promise, and to accept her responsibility. Ironically, these suggestions had originally come from the Witch of the Coos. They met in the Willow Grove, in several of the abandoned boathouses which stood crumbling at the northern hook of the bay, in a herder's hut far out in the desolation of the Coos, in an abandoned squatter's shack hidden in the bad grass. The settings were, by and large, as sordid as any of those in which addicts come together to practice their vice, but Susan and Roland didn't see the rotting walls of the shack, or the holes in the roof of the hut, or smell the moldering nets in the corners of the old soaked boathouses. They were drugged, stone in love, and to them every scar on the face of the world was a beauty mark. Twice, early on, in those delirious weeks, they used the red rock in the wall at the back of the pavilion to arrange meetings, and then some deep voice spoke inside Roland's head, telling him there must be no more of it. The rock might have been just the thing for children playing at secrets, but he and his love were no longer children. If they were discovered, banishment would be the luckiest punishment they could hope for. The red rock was too conspicuous, and writing things down, even messages that were unsigned and deliberately vague, was horribly dangerous. Using shimi felt safer to both of them. Beneath his smiling light-mindedness, there was a surprising depth of, well, discretion. Roland had thought long and hard before settling on that word, and it was the right word, an ability to keep silent that was more dignified than mere cunning. Cunning was out of Shimi's reach in any case, and always would be. A man who couldn't tell a lie without shifting his eyes away from yours was a man who would never be considered cunning. They used Shimi half a dozen times over the 5 weeks when their physical love burned at its hottest. 3 of those times were to make meetings, 2 were to change meeting places, and 1 was to cancel a tryst when Susan spied riders from the piano ranch sweeping for strays near the shack in the bad grass. That deep warning voice never spoke to Roland about Shimi as it had about the dangers of the red rock. But his conscience spoke to him, and when he finally mentioned this to Susan, the two of them wrapped in a saddle blanket and lying naked in each other's arms, he found that her conscience had been troubling her as well. It wasn't fair to put the boy in the way of their possible trouble. After coming to that conclusion, Roland and Susan arranged their meeting strictly between the two of them. If she could not meet him, Susan said, she would hang a red shirt over the sill of her window as if to dry. If he could not meet her, he was to leave a white stone in the northeast corner of the yard, diagonally across the road from Hookie's livery, where the town pump stood. As a last resort, they would use the red rock in the pavilion, risky or not, rather than bringing Shimi into their affairs, their affair, again. Cuthbert and Elaine watched Roland's descent into addiction, first with disbelief, envy, and uneasy amusement, then with a species of silent horror. They had been sent to what was supposed to have been safety, and had discovered a place of conspiracy instead. They had come to take census in a barony where most of the aristocracy had apparently switched its allegiance to the affiliation's bitterest enemy. They had made personal enemies of 3 hard men who had probably killed enough folks to populate a fair-sized graveyard. Yet they had felt equal to the situation, because they had come here under the leadership of their friend, who had attained near mythic status in their minds by besting court with a hawk as his weapon and becoming a gunslinger at the unheard-of age of 14. That they had been given guns themselves for this mission had meant a great deal to them when they set out from Gilead, and nothing at all by the time they began to realize the scope of what was going on in Hambrytown and the barony of which it was a part. When that realization came, Roland was the weapon they counted on. And now, he's like a revolver cast into water, Cuthbert exclaimed one evening, not long after Roland had ridden away to meet Susan. Beyond the bunkhouse porch, Huntress rose in her first quarter. "Gods know if it'll ever fire again, even if it's fished out and dried off." "Hush, wait," Alain said, and looked toward the porch rail. Hoping to jolly Cuthbert out of his bad temper, a task that was quite easy under ordinary circumstances, Alain said, "Where's the lookout? Gone to bed early for once, has he?" This only irritated Cuthbert more. He hadn't seen the rook's skull in days, he couldn't exactly say how many, and he took its loss as an ill omen. "Gone, but not to bed," he replied, then looked balefully to the west, where Roland had disappeared aboard his big old galoot of a horse. "Lost, I reckon, like a certain fellow's mind and heart and good sense." "He'll be all right," Alain said awkwardly. "You know him as well as I do, Bert. Known him our whole lives, we have. He'll be all right." Quietly, without even a trace of his normal good humor, Cuthbert said, "I don't feel I know him now." They had both tried to talk to Roland in their different ways. Both received a similar response, which was no real response at all. The dreamy and perhaps slightly troubled look of abstraction in Roland's eyes during these one-sided discussions would have been familiar to anyone who has ever tried to talk sense to a drug addict. It was a look that said Roland's mind was occupied by the shape of Susan's face, the smell of Susan's skin, the feel of Susan's body, and occupied was a silly word for it, one that fell short. It wasn't an occupation, but an obsession. "I hate her a little for what she's done," Cuthbert said, and there was a note in his voice Alain had never heard before, a mixture of jealousy, frustration, and fear. "Perhaps more than a little."
"You mustn't."
Alain tried not to sound shocked, but couldn't help it. "She isn't responsible for—"
"Is she not? She went out to Sitka with him. She saw what he saw.
God knows how much else he's told her after they've finished making the beast with two backs. And she's all the way around the world from stupid. Just the way she's managed her side of their affair shows that." Bert was thinking, Alain guessed, of her tidy little trick with the Corvette. "She must know she's become part of the problem herself. She must know that." Now his bitterness was frighteningly clear. "He's jealous of her for stealing his best friend," Alain thought. "But it doesn't stop there. He's jealous of his best friend as well, because his best friend is one the most beautiful girl any of us have ever seen." Alain leaned over and grasped Cuthbert's shoulder. When Bert turned away from his morose examination of the dooryard to look at his friend, he was startled by the grimness on Alain's face. "It's Kaa," Alain said. Cuthbert almost sneered. "If I had a hot dinner for every time someone blamed theft or lust or some other stupidity on Kaa..." Alain's grip tightened until it became painful. Cuthbert could have pulled away, but didn't. He watched Alain closely. The joker was, temporarily at least, gone. "Blame is exactly what we two can't afford," Alain said. "Don't you see that? And if it's Kaa that swept them away, we needn't blame. We can't blame. We must rise above it. We need him. And we may need her, too." Cuthbert looked into Alain's eyes for what seemed to be a very long time. Alain saw Bert's anger at war with his good sense. At last, and perhaps only for the time being, good sense won out. "All right, fine, it's Kaa, everybody's favorite whipping boy. That's what the great unseen world's for, after all, isn't it? So we don't have to take the blame for our acts of stupidity. Now let go of me, Al, before you break my shoulder." Alain let go and sat back in his chair, relieved. "Now if we only knew what to do about the drop. If we don't start counting there soon..." "I've had an idea about that, actually," Cuthbert said. "It just needs a little working out. I'm sure Roland could help, if either of us can get his attention for a few minutes, that is." They sat for a while without speaking, looking out at the dooryard. Inside the bunkhouse, the pigeons, another bone of contention between Roland and Bert these days, cooed. Alain rolled himself a smoke. It was slow work, and the finished product looked rather comical, but it held together when he lit it. "Your father would stripe you raw if he saw that in your hand," Cuthbert remarked, but he spoke with a certain admiration. By the time the following year's Huntress came around, all three of them would be confirmed smokers, tanned young men with most of the boyhood slapped out of their eyes. Alain nodded. The strong outer crescent tobacco made him swimmy in the head and raw in the throat, but a cigarette had a way of calming his nerves, and right now his nerves could use some calming. He didn't know about Bert, but these days he smelled blood on the wind. Possibly some of it would be their own. He wasn't exactly frightened, not yet at least, but he was very, very worried. 4. Although they had been honed like hawks toward the guns since early childhood, Cuthbert and Alain still carried an erroneous belief common to many boys their age, that their elders were also their betters, at least in such matters as planning and wit. They actually believed that grown-ups knew what they were doing. Roland knew better, even in his lovesickness, but his friends had forgotten that in the game of castles, both sides wear the blindfold. They would have been surprised to find that at least two of the big coffin hunters had grown extremely nervous about the three young men from Inworld, and extremely tired of the waiting game both sides had been playing. One early morning, as the huntress neared the half, Reynolds and DePape came downstairs together from the second floor of the Traveler's Rest. The main public room was silent, except for various snores and phlegmy wheezings. In Hambry's busiest bar, the party was over for another night. Jonas, accompanied by a silent guest, sat playing Chancellor's Patience at Coral's table to the left of the batwing doors. Tonight he was wearing his duster, and his breath smoked faintly as he bent over his cards. It wasn't cold enough to frost, not quite yet, but the frost would come soon. The chill in the air left no doubt of that. The breath of his guest also smoked. Kimba Reimer's skeletal frame was all but buried in a gray serape lit with faint bands of orange. The two of them had been on the edge of getting down to business when Roy and Clay, Pinch and Jilly, Reimer thought, showed up, their plowing and planting in the second floor cribs also apparently over for another night.
Eldred, Reynolds said, and then, Cy Reimer?
Reimer nodded back, looking from Reynolds to DePape with thin distaste.
Long days and pleasant nights, gentlemen. Of course the world had moved on, he thought. To find such low culls as these two in positions of importance proved it. Jonas himself was only a little better.
Might we have a word with you, Eldred? Clay Reynolds asked. We've been talking, Roy and I, unwise,
Jonas remarked in his wavery voice.
Reimer wouldn't be surprised to find at the end of his life that the Death Angel had such a voice. Talking can lead to thinking, and thinking's dangerous for such as you boys, like picking your nose with bullet heads.
DePape donkeyed his damned hee-haw laughter as if he didn't realize the joke was on him.
"Jonas, listen," Reynolds began, and then looked uncertainly at Reimer.
"You can talk in front of Cy Reimer," Jonas said, laying out a fresh line of cards. "He is, after all, our chief employer. I play at Chancellor's Patience in his honor, so I do."
Reynolds looked surprised.
"I thought... That is to say, I believed that Mayor Thorin was..."
"Hart Thorin wants to know none of the details of our arrangement with the good man," Reimer said. "A share of the profits is all he requires in that line, Mr. Reynolds. The mayor's chief concern right now is that the Reaping Day Fair go smoothly, and that his arrangements with the young lady be smoothly consummated."
"Aye, that's a diplomatic turn of speech for ye," Jonas said in a broad mage's accent. "But since Roy looks a little perplexed, I'll translate. Mayor Thorin spends most of his time in the Jakes these days, yanking his willy pink and dreaming his fist is Susan Delgado's box. I'm betting that when the shell's finally opened and her pearl lies before him, he'll never pluck it. His heart'll explode from excitement, and he'll drop dead atop her, so he will yar."
More donkey laughter from DePape. He elbowed Reynolds.
"He's got it down, don't he, Clay? Sounds just like him."
Reynolds grinned, but his eyes were still worried. Reimer managed a smile as thin as a scum of November ice and pointed at the seven which had just popped out of the pack.
"Red on black, my dear Jonas." "I ain't your dear anything," Jonas said, putting the seven of diamonds on an eight of shadows, "and you'd do well to remember that."
Then to Reynolds and DePape,
"Now what do you boys want? Reimer and me was just going to have us a little palaver."
"Perhaps we could all put our heads together," Reynolds said, putting a hand on the back of a chair, "kind of see if our thinking matches up."
"I think not," Jonas said, sweeping his cards together.
He looked irritated, and Clay Reynolds took his hand off the back of the chair in a hurry.
"Say your say and be done with it. It's late." "We was thinking it's time to go on out there to the barquet," DePape said. "Have a look around. See if there's anything to back up what the old fella in Ritzy said." "And see what else they've got out there," Reynolds put in. "It's getting close now, Eldred, and
We can't afford to take chances. They might have... Aye? Guns? Electric lights? Fairy women in bottles? Who knows? I'll think about it, Clay.
But I said I'll think about it. Now go on upstairs, the both of you, back to your own fairy women.
Reynolds and DePape looked at him, looked at each other, then backed away from the table. Reimer watched them with his thin smile. At the foot of the stairs, Reynolds turned back. Jonas paused in the act of shuffling his cards and looked at him, tufted eyebrows raised.
"We underestimated him once, and they made us look like monkeys. I don't want it to happen again, that's all."
"Your ass is still sore over that, isn't it? Well, so is mine, and I tell you again, they'll pay for what they did. I have the bill ready, and when the time comes, I'll present it to them, with all interest duly noted. In the meantime, they aren't going to spook me into making the first move. Time is on our side, not theirs. Do you understand that?"
"Yes."
"Will you try to remember it?"
"Yes,"
Reynolds repeated. He seemed satisfied.
"Roy, do you trust me?"
"Aye, Aldred, to the end."
Jonas had praised him for the work he had done in Ritzy, and DePape had rolled in it the way a male dog rolls in the scent of a bitch.
"Then go on up, the both of you, and let me palaver with the boss and be done with it. I'm too old for these late nights."
When they were gone, Jonas dealt out a fresh line of cards, then looked around the room.